Well, I mean, I think that that certainly is can be this question about accountability and compliance can certainly be added to the list of challenges. I mean, we operate as a U.S. government agency within a legal framework, and that's determined in large measure by legislation. So obviously, what we what we're trying to do is to essentially identify what we can do given the legal requirements that we have at the moment. At the same time, I think that we do feel that by putting out a clear statement on what our objectives are and how we are going to achieve them, that we hope that one result of this is to sort of explain to perhaps skeptics, perhaps on the Hill or elsewhere, that providing, that this kind of an approach makes sense, that sustainability is a valued objective of the agency, and that indeed providing funding directly to organizations is an important part of it, that it's all sort of part of a well-thought-out strategy. So that's, and as part of this consultation process, we are talking to a broad cross-section of individuals and organizations, both our partners in implementation, but also others who shape the sort of policy community around this topic. So on the Hill and think tanks and so forth. So that's the strategy.
Hello? Yes. Hi. Mike Lennon. Several, I guess GW is an organization, I'd say. First, go, go to.
Well, it's more than me.
Well, and the community of like-minded. A question that I heard you say, which is like where to begin and how to extend might be USAID as a learning system. And the degree to which people can learn across the USAID world and the partners in the ecosystem of USAID can become more effective at learning because, not just aid, but most development projects, the failure rates are 50% or higher, and there's not honest exchange of why that is and how it is. And so if we can transform people's experience of what it means to relate to things that didn't go as expected, and how do non-results produce insight into future results, we can help folks get something that currently they're not getting. And once people have the experience, you don't have to, they naturally start acting in the way rather than needing more preaching and policy.
Great. Thanks. That's a great suggestion.
Can we take another question from the webinar? Okay. This is a question from Jody Unaik. She is a senior technical advisor from USAID IDEA, GP. And her question is, how would you connect these notions of systemic thinking to cross-cutting approaches and the issues related to how USAID is organized, both regionally and sectorally, to get work done?
Well, I think you put your finger on a big challenge, and I think it's not only a challenge for this effort, but as you implied, for any cross-cutting effort, because for some activities there are natural organizational homes within USAID, and for others there are these things do cross-cut, and there are people working on it from a variety of different perspectives. I mean, I think that at least one of the objectives that we were trying to do with the paper was to provide a bit more sort of space for anybody who was sort of working on these systems-type concepts in their own particular areas to feel as if they had more sort of overarching support, but also, I think, to create the opportunities for more cross-fertilization. And I think the point that earlier point that was made about, you know, how do we learn from each other? And so, I think that on the one hand, I think that one of the strengths is the fact that we have examples and applications and so forth in quite diverse technical areas and in different parts of the world. But at the same time, and that perhaps provides opportunities for learning. But I think that one of the challenges that keeps coming back and has been a subject of conversation even within those 60 people on the listserv is, do we need sort of an organizational home? How do we keep essentially a community of practice alive that is able to not only just sort of inform, but actually begins to have some influence on the actions that we take? And as I said, we don't have a magic answer for that.
Okay, thanks. So I have it's kind of a question and a comment. I think sort of one thing that would really help, you talked about incentives and how to sort of improve uptake on this, and I think sort of really articulating what the benefits of it are, and that sustainability is a word that is so used in this space, and that everybody promises that everything will give you sustainability all the time. And so if you, a little cynical, but sort of how do you articulate what the benefits of this are beyond sustainability, and particularly for a very practically minded group of people, sort of what that means about how it makes their jobs and their design easier or better, as opposed to this is one more thing that has come on top of every other policy reform.
Can I press you, though, on that? Is there any, do you have any, I agree with you, but the question is, how do we do that? To me, the way I would say it is that making this investment and trying to move in this direction to think more systemically may take some effort on the front end. So that it's not costless. But on the other hand, the benefits will be greater. So we need to figure out a way to sort of demonstrate that, but it's a little hard to do that if they haven't been willing to take that first step themselves. So the question as you rightly pointed out, we have hung an awful lot of this on the sustainability lens, but if there are other ways that we can talk about these benefits and make them, clear and practical, maybe there are examples that we can point to, we'd love to know what those are. Because I think your strategy is absolutely right.
Yeah, I'd say one thing is if you've got sort of 60 people in a community practice. So if you've got sort of 60 people who are in a community of practice who are interested and excited about this, they can talk about what they've been doing sort of in a broader group, or if there are ways to kind of showcase those examples, or reach out to peer organizations. I think also some of it is framing in how this helps you avoid pitfalls. So one thing that systems thinking is great for is that it helps you not run into a problem 2 years down the line because you didn't think about it, because you weren't thinking about the system, you were thinking about something much smaller. So I think there are lots of benefits that you could articulate that are a little shorter term and sort of easier for people to get their heads around.
Jane Downing from USAID. I just wanted to comment on that. I wonder whether some of these benefits would be more quickly realized if we moved from the general systems thinking en general to the actual programmatic areas in which we work. So Eric is working in health systems, and he has been working in health systems for some time and been thinking about it and has some really interesting thinking. We've been working in market systems. Our practitioners feel we've been doing this for some years. We clearly have a lot more to learn. But whether, and when you get down to the technical areas, be it health or education or market systems, then systems become a a tool, a way of thinking that helps us
address certain problems, you know, rather than... So anyway, I just wonder whether that would help things catch on more if we move to more specific.
That's because that I think is a very good thought. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are clearly areas, as you mentioned, where this kind of thinking has really made important inroads in the way in which people come to the problem. So that may very well make some sense. I think one of the other things that we've also considered is the possibility of perhaps identifying a limited number of missions that may, where there is already perhaps a predisposition to sort of embrace some of this and sort of work more directly with a limited set of missions to both support what they're trying to do as well as sort of learn some of their practical problems in terms of moving this forward. So the point's well taken. Small bites at the apple.
I have another question from one of our webinar participants. This is from Lauren Kasky at DAI. And the first is a comment. She says that understanding the local system is key. And if she understands correctly, this involves examining resources, roles, relationships, results, etc. And her question is, how do we ensure during this mapping exercise that the voices of the most marginalized are heard?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think that, there's actually some language in the paper itself that says that's part of what we mean. I mean, I think that certainly one of the things, but I think it probably deserves to be reemphasized. I think that one of the things, as I said, that I've really sort of come to really more deeply appreciate about what Bob Williams was talking about is this issue around perspectives and how it really is, since we are operating, this system is essentially a mental construct, different people are going to have different visions about what the system is. And it's really, I think, one of the values of this is to sort of really to understand that the way we may think about healthcare delivery or we may think about agriculture, maize production may not necessarily be the way that even the people who are engaged in those activities think about it, and that it's really very important for us to get a better sense of perspective of it, the range of perspectives. And I think that clearly understanding and being committed to sort of looking beyond usual suspects and the power brokers in society and sort of looking at those who are more marginalized is an important part of it. That said, again, we have... within USAID, both now and in the past, an avalanche of different assessment tools, and I think that one of the challenges that we face is coming up with some sort of a sweet spot, a sort of good enough assessment. What's good enough in terms of being able to understand the dynamics that are going on within a system. And so on, without sort of expecting that we're going to require a two-year deep anthropological study, because that has been a road we've gone down in the past. And so I think that it's really more a question of coming up with practical, thoughtful ways of doing it, but at the same time trying not to overburden with too much expectations.
Hello. So my name is Jacob Gray. I'm with ACD Ivoca. And I found the comment that the man from GW is talking about and very interesting, and also linking to the program risks component, which, in some ways, in a lot of the worlds that we work in as implementers, the program risk is not achieving the results and the targets that you have anticipated from day one in a proposal down to day five or down to year five. And we spend a lot of time slogging through sometimes some very static approaches because the program risk of not achieving those is poor reputation, loss of funding, et cetera, et cetera. What I find in a systemic approach really interesting and important is that a system is dynamic. and to think that if we are having a systemic effect over 5 years, we should actually see some changes in which maybe our approaches that we started with do no longer fit with the systemic change that we're working on. And so the question of a non-result being a non-result, actually with the right questions and the right research, a non-result can actually be a very profound result in a systemic approach or in a systemic program. So some way to work through USAID in their programming and in the incentives to how to do good programming that rewards this sort of continual R&D process and the adaptation and, you know, still being held accountable surely to our targets and our results, but also being able to redefine those as we move along in our programming is really important.
No, I think you're absolutely, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we do talk about, there's one of our principles about flexibility and finding ways to be able to make those adjustments. I think that it's also clear that, you know, we learn as we engage collectively, and the system sort of, you know, makes adjustments. And so trying to create the space for that kind of thing is really, I think, central. But it again goes back to, and this has been a topic that has been sort of fairly recurrent in this kind of seminar and so forth, is, you know, but at the same time, you know, trying to accommodate that within the existing procedures and so forth is a challenge. Now, I think we are trying to work on increasing the flexibility, but I think we've got a ways to go.
Wonderful. So going back to the webinar audience, it's a very active chat. We've gotten a lot of questions and comments from everyone online. I'm going to state a comment first from Mary McKnight Bay, and then a follow-up question from Elizabeth Dunn. So Mary stated that we have learned in value chain development that engagement on all fronts, from businesses in the market system to policymakers and funders, is that we have to have a strong short, medium, and long-term results. Without strong short-term, obvious results, the approach won't work on the ground or with supporters. So showing that a systems approach brings stronger short-term results is key, and it usually does. And Elizabeth followed on to that with a question and asked, she said, something that might be helpful for implementers would be early indicators of systemic change. And how do we monitor so that we know when this early change is emerging?
Those both sound like great ideas. I don't know if either of them have some examples where they've actually done something like that. That would be helpful to know whether. I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of direction that we need to go. You know, how do we see signs that the system is changing and try to capture that fairly quickly? Not only, it seems to me, for the sort of reporting requirements, but also, I think, to feed back into the process about, you know, are we really on the right path? Do we need to make adjustments and so on? I mean, and I think that thinking about short, medium, and long-term results obviously is a sensible way to go. But, you know, I think if there are examples where that has actually been, attempted in practice, and there are some, you know, there's a story to be told about that. That I would, in particular, be interested in knowing how that was done.
USAID recently embraced the Women Empowerment Index for educators.
I think the Women Empowerment Index seems like an excellent start to systematic thinking about women in developing countries, particularly in agriculture. Do you think that could be a great start to a more bringing that into every program?
I think the way I would sort of approach this is, and it goes back to one of the questions or comments that was made earlier about making sure that you are engaging with marginalized populations. And so it seems to me that certainly in some cases women have been sort of a marginalized and sort of neglected group as a whole. So part of what I think is really is important is as we sort of try to understand the system and the various different perspectives, that we understand the perspectives also from a gender point of view. I mean, whether the index itself is an appropriate one, I don't have the detail to be able to answer that.
Let's take another question from the room.
A lot of the comments, beginning with the introduction, seem to focus on how do we get systems thinking framework to adapt itself to the way aid business operates. And I think the work of William Easterly, Chris Coyne, Ben Ramalingam pretty much have brought out the evidence that the aid business has become far too internal in its thinking. It's far less effective in the context, the larger context within which it operates. So I'd like to turn the question on its head is how aid business can, or how systems thinking framework can help aid business to recognize that it's no longer doing the creating the results that it thinks it's creating. It's creating results that match its internal incentives but don't match the needs of the larger environment within which it's working.
Well, since I'm essentially up here in talking about this paper representing the agency, I have my own personal views on the matter, but I think that what I would only say is that, I think that there's a lot to be said. I think particularly from Ben's new book about the mismatch between the tools that development agencies have at their disposal and the way they go about deploying them and the nature of the development problem. But I think that, again, we are a creature of both executive branch and legislative branch approaches here. And despite our own, where our own predilections are, we operate within a framework. And so I think those are really important, those critiques are important ones. And I would just say I think there are others to whom they should be addressed.
So we'll take another couple of questions from the webinar. Chip, a couple of people have had questions. You mentioned a listserv earlier, and some of our online participants were wondering how they might join the listserv.
Okay. Well, that listserv that I was referring to is only internal to USAID. So if the people who are asking are internal, then they can send me an email and we'll get them on it. I think that – but the larger point, I think, is – and again, I don't – we have platforms for broader exchange with the external community, most particularly Learning Lab, which is a platform we've created within the last year or so to sponsor these kinds of and of course this microlinks as well. So I think that clearly this, one of the things I'm already taking away is sort of thinking about how can we continue to support and engage in this broader learning, sort of peer-to-peer learning a process and use it to our advantage. And so I think that thinking about how to make sure that we, continue to have this kind of conversation after this session ends and so forth is going to be important. So if it's internal, we'll get you, we can get you signed up right away. If it's external, we'll put some more effort into thinking about how we can and what the appropriate vehicle is for sort of continuing this kind of conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you. One more question that I wanted to get in there. This is from Scott Yetter. over at Global Communities in Washington, D.C., and he asked, where does political will and authority fit into systems thinking, and how will USAID play a more progressive role, or how might USAID play a more progressive role in supporting implementing partners working in contexts where the local systems are not inclusive, but good development requires more inclusive systems? And just to follow on, will this type of thinking propel USAID to make a stronger stand for good development?
Okay, there's a lot in that question. So let me take a couple let me sort of point out a couple of things. I mean, one of them is that I think that the implicit concerns that were in the question. So in other words, local systems are, I mean, we've been talking about USAID existing within a foreign policy system here in the United States. I mean, these systems exist within rule structures that distribute a power and authority within countries. Sometimes, though, you know, we've identified that there's an incompatibility with the objectives that we're trying to achieve and the rule structures that exist. And so clearly, by putting rules front and center in what we're talking about in these five R's, is sort of saying we need to be more attentive to the way in which these rules operate. And I think implicit in that, and I mean, we have some track record in this area, that there are ways that we can use our programming resources, including conditionality, as ways to address those binding rule-based constraints. Oftentimes, there are reformers within the societies that we can partner with to achieve those particular ends. So I think one point is about the emphasis that we've placed on rules. The second thing I would say is that we've made a very big emphasis in there, and there's a really nice example in the paper about accountability. And I think that on one hand, we say it is one of the principles is that we need to be, you know, because of this sort of systems construct, we need to understand that there are systems operating in all environments. So some of those systems may be quite deplorable in terms of what the results are and so forth. And the question is always then, what's the best way to do it? Do you go around it? Do you engage with it? How do you engage with it and so forth? I mean, that's a problem that we as implementers working in sometimes difficult situations deal with all the time. The issue that we're saying here, though, is to sort of reemphasize a point that came out of a recent USAID strategy on democracy, rights, human rights, and governance, which is to emphasize the opportunities for accountability outside of sort of the formalized political processes. And so one of the things that we push on this is the fact that there may very well be opportunities to work on those accountability relationships even in otherwise difficult situations. How can you begin to start, you know, ensuring that parents have some degree of accountability over the education that their children are receiving from schools? How do you ensure that the users of health clinics have an ability to have some degree of accountability on the healthcare that's being delivered to them? And there are, you know, a variety of ways of doing it. And not only does that, it's, you know, as the example shows, is that makes sense from an idea of sort of empowering local people, but it actually ultimately improves the results as well. The last thing I would say about it, and one of the reasons we made such a pitch on this accountability, is that I think we've come to the conclusion that it is those accountability aspects of systems that give it its adaptability. And that adaptability is really critical because that's, as I've mentioned before, because ultimately that's what gives it the sustainability. I mean, we're not trying to create rigid systems that here that don't have the ability to adapt. We need to create those adaptive capabilities because environments change, and the systems need to be able to adapt. So I think we've got several ways that we sort of have identified this question about, sort of understanding sort of the power dynamics that exist, what we may be able to do about it, and the importance of accountability.
And we'll take one last question from the room. And if we didn't get to your question, please go on the MicroLinks event page and under comments, post your question there, and I'll work with Chip to get your question answered.
Hi, my name is Glenn Burnett. I'm with Practical Action. One of my colleagues at Practical Action has been working with the SEAT Network to develop
a systemic approach to M&E. And I think some of the things that you're talking about right now really kind of get in almost a chicken or the egg situation, where you want to be able to show that systemic work has impact, but a lot of the impacts that you actually get with the systemic approach is actually going to be focused more on indirect impacts that come from some of the other parts of the system that you're working in. And I guess the question that I was going to have for you is recognizing that sometimes the M&E systems that are used to pull out results that come from these kinds of approaches are in fact more direct in structure. How do you get those examples that you're looking for that maybe are not going to automatically be apparent within the current M&E structure that we use?
Of the four topics that we sort of identified as sort of areas that we're actually slightly farther ahead on the M&E one than on some of the others. There has been an interest, particularly within the lead office on a monitoring and evaluation within USAID Learning Evaluation Research, to already begin to sort of say. Looking more broadly and saying what kinds of monitoring and evaluation techniques are out there to sort of understand how to get at these sort of deeper questions. And we have a note that we're making available throughout the agency that's sort of talking about them and testing out some of these ideas. I mean, this question about, you know, how do we monitor in these difficult, I mean, there has been a challenge for several years as we've been engaging in high conflict areas and so forth, where we've needed a lot of adaptability and so on to try to figure out how to measure the effects that we're having in those. And so there has been this crying need, and it predated our work on the systems, although there's obviously some advantages. So, I mean, just as, you know, one example is essentially, it is qualitative. But, I mean, this is why I emphasize this point about ongoing engagement with actors in the system, is like bringing them together and just asking them, are things working? You know, what needs to be changed? Are the assumptions that we made together when we started this thing really still applicable or not? And then do we have the ability to make adjustments? I mean, I've personally been involved in a project that sort of worked that way, and I just, you know, I didn't realize how unusual it was at the time, but it just worked extraordinarily well. And to me, one of the other big important parts of it is that, you know, when you start talking to different parts of a system, and they don't necessarily understand or know all the other actors that are there. And by bringing them all together and beginning to create the sense that this happened to be in a input marketing system that, you know, the importers, the bankers, the distributors, the end users, and so forth, were all part of a system that they, you know, that they began to realize, yes, we were competitors in some respects, but we all have a shared interest in seeing the system survive and to thrive. And so what do we need to do to make this, you know, make these kinds of improvements? So at least that's one technique, but it's not by any means the only one.
Please join me in thanking Chip Walker. And thank you all for your comments and questions. We are taking a break in December for the holidays, but we will resume in January. So please stay tuned for more MPEP seminars. Thank you.